welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 12, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Three people are dead in what appears to be a domestic abuse-linked crime as Wisconsin and Iowa officials investigate what happened Wednesday that ended in the suspected suicide of the shooter, the slaying of a Dubuque County woman, and the unexplained death of a 13-year-old girl. Alexander C. Grunke of Middleton, Wisconsin, was identified as the shooter who authorities said killed himself after a pursuit and an armed standoff with law enforcement in Albion, Wisconsin, about 30 miles southeast of Madison. He was in his late 30s. A 13-year-old girl who was riding with him during the chase and who was reportedly shooting at pursuing squad cars also died nearby in the woods, though the cause of her death is undetermined. She has not been identified. 2 hours after the shootout, the Dubuque County Sheriff's Office found Tana Poppy, 32, dead at her home in rural Dubuque County. Poppy's death is being investigated as a homicide, and Grunke is considered a person of interest in her slaying, the sheriff's office said. The 13-year-old girl had been staying with Poppy at her home, as had a 5-month-old baby, authorities said. Dane County, Wisconsin Sheriff Calvin Barrett detailed what happened in a Thursday news conference. He said the sheriff's office received a call at about 5:30 p.m. Wednesday from a family who told them Grunke and a 13-year-old girl had dropped off a 5-month-old child at their house in Dunn, Wisconsin. The family gave sheriff's deputies information about the vehicle, a black Ford Escape, that Grunke and the girl had left in. Deputies found the car and attempted a traffic stop, but were led on a chase through the county. Both Grunke and the girl fired weapons, a handgun and a rifle, at the deputies pursuing them. The deputies did not return fire, the sheriff said. Law enforcement officers stopped the car in Albion, Wisconsin, about 15 miles from where the baby had been dropped off, using tire deflation devices. Grunke and the girl fled. The girl ran into a wooded area and was later found unresponsive. Deputies tried to revive her, but she was pronounced dead from an unknown cause. Barrett said at the news conference the girl had no obvious wounds and no weapons were found with her. Grunke ran into a house on Ramsey Road in Albion, firing several rounds into the house and barricaded himself in the basement. Deputies were able to remove the family that lived there, and they were uninjured. Dane County deputies attempted to talk to Grunke, but were unable to make contact with him. Eventually, deputies used a robot to enter the home and found Grunke dead, an apparent suicide, at around 7 a.m. Thursday. Deputies did not discharge their weapons during the chase or the standoff, and none of the deputies involved were injured, Barrett said. At 7:11 p.m. Wednesday, 2 hours after the baby was dropped off in Dunn, and while the standoff was ongoing in Albion, the Dubuque County Sheriff's Office was called to 9866 Haxby Lane Road, about 10 miles south of Dubuque, where they found Poppy's body. Dane County records show Poppy and Grunke shared a 9-year-old daughter, according to online court records. Poppy petitioned for a restraining order against Grunke twice in October 2023, and records show multiple text messages in which she referred to him as a predator of children, telling him to leave her and her children alone, the Wisconsin State Journal reported. Police have not said anything about the 10-year-old girl's whereabouts. Also, the relationship between Grunke and the 13-year-old and infant wasn't immediately clear, according to authorities. On March 26th, Grunke was charged in Dane County with abduction of child, interference with child custody, and knowingly violating a domestic abuse injunction. The case had not gone to trial. Court records indicate Grunke is 38 years old, though Dane County officials reported he was either 37 or 39. A retired Cedar Rapids police officer who was the first to respond to a death at Hawthorne Hills apartment complex on May 11, 2007, found the victim lying on his back in a hide-a-bed with his feet on the floor and blood around his upper torso and head. Stephen Yardley, the retired police officer, testified the tenant, Dennis First, 64, was already dead. He wasn't breathing and seemed to have been dead for some time. Yardley found a cat, but no other people in the apartment as he conducted a protective sweep. Yardley said First had significant trauma, a wound to the right side of his neck. There was also blood on the floor and near the bed. Curtis Padgett, 42, who lived in the complex at 2249 C Street Southwest, just downstairs from First, is being tried on first-degree murder charge this week. He is accused of brutally and savagely beating and stabbing to death First, a prosecutor said in her brief opening statement Thursday. Todd Weimer, one of Padgett's lawyers, during his opening, said the prosecution won't be able to meet its burden and prove Padgett is the killer. The evidence is circumstantial, and the blood and print evidence found in First's apartment won't prove Padgett's guilt, Weimer said. First and Padgett were friends, and Padgett had been in his apartment many times. This was a cold case until March 2023, when Padgett was initially arrested for threatening to burn down Geneva Tower, where he lived in 2023. He was then charged in First's death, but police declined to reveal what evidence broke open the case. Assistant Linn County Attorney Jennifer Erger didn't address the break in the case during her opening. It's likely that information may be revealed through law enforcement testimony during the trial, expected to wrap up early next week. Before jury selection started Wednesday, Padgett waived his right to a jury trial and asked for a bench or a non-jury trial. Sixth Judicial District Judge Ian Thornhill will decide the verdict in this case. Yardley testified that apartment management opened the door when someone asked them to conduct a welfare check on First that day. He noted the thermostat was set on 60 degrees, which seemed unusual to him because it was very cool in the apartment and it was only about 70 degrees outside that day. Yardley said he also found blood on the countertop and cabinet in the kitchen, and there was an oven mitt saturated in blood in a kitchen drawer next to the stove. Dr. Jonathan Thompson, a state deputy medical examiner and forensic pathologist, testified about the injuries found on First during an autopsy conducted May 12, 2007, by another medical examiner who died in 2014. Thompson reviewed her report and other information and came to his own conclusions, which were consistent with the other medical examiner. Both medical examiners found First died from at least two sharp force injuries. Stabbing injuries made by a knife or another sharp object on the right side of First's neck. The wound was about 6 inches in length and about 1 to 1.5 inches deep. The stabbing injuries penetrated his neck muscle and jugular vein in his neck, causing his death, Thompson said. First also had multiple blunt force injuries to his face and head, which contributed to his death. There was large bruising and abrasions to his right and left cheeks of his face, abrasions to his chin area, nasal bone fracture, and bruising, scrapes and abrasions to his lips inside and outside. His mouth also had cuts and hemorrhaging as if someone struck him in the mouth, Thompson said. First also had hemorrhaging of his brain, bruising and bleeding underneath his scalp, consistent with someone striking his head on an object. He also suffered broken ribs, the result of multiple blunt blows, Thompson described, which could be caused by someone stomping on him. There were also two reddish bruises to the top of his right forearm and bruising on the inside of his forearm and a skin tear. Thompson said first had some health issues, including emphysema and an enlarged prostate and coronary artery disease, but none of these contributed to his death. The cause of death was the stab wound to his neck and multiple blunt force injuries to his chest and head. The manner of death was homicide. In other testimony, Mark Stender, who now lives in Ohio and provided his testimony over the phone, lived in Hawthorne Hills in May 2007 and was a neighbor to First and Padgett. Stender said he used to play cards with First and was familiar with Padgett from the building. Stender said he last saw First about 12:30 p.m. May 10th. At that time, First didn't have any injuries and was alone in his apartment. The next day, he learned First had been killed. Robert Gross, a former maintenance technician at Hawthorne Hills in 2007, said he used his master key to enter First's apartment after management had been asked by someone to do a welfare check. Gross saw First's body on the bed and blood on his neck. David Palumbo, a former Hawthorne Hills neighbor, testified he was sleeping and awoke to loud arguing upstairs on May 10, 2007. He identified the voices as Padgett and First. He couldn't hear what they were arguing about, but he said it was loud. He said the walls were as thin as paper. He then went back to sleep and didn't know First had been killed until the next day. On cross-examination, Palumbo said he didn't tell police about the argument he heard until 2009. Weimer asked him if a police report said it was August 2022. Would he dispute it? But Palumbo said he didn't recall it being then. ACT Incorporated, long known for its standardized tests before more recently pursuing a broader mission of research, education, and college and career readiness, this week announced a major collaboration with a large California investment firm, shifting the Iowa City-based ACT from a nonprofit to a for-profit company. Upon closing the deal with Nexus Capital Management LP, a Los Angeles private equity firm, ACT, and an education data research organization it owns, will operate as a single unified public benefit corporation. Essentially, according to a spokesman, ACT will become a type of for-profit company under the ACT name and brand. This partnership will create more pathways to degrees, credentials, and skill acquisition for people at any age of their lives, Daniel Dominic, chair of ACT's board of directors and former executive director of the School Superintendents Association, said in a statement. The time is right to move into the next phase of ACT's long-term growth strategy alongside a partner with a significant industry expertise, giving ACT the scale and capital necessary to deliver on its promise of education and workplace success, he said. As a nonprofit, ACT's past public filings show budget deficits every year between 2019 and 2022, with 2023 filings not yet public. Those deficits total $113.5 million, including a loss of $60.6 million in 2020 alone. The last year ACT reported a surplus was in 2018. Of $21.3 million. Upon closing with Nexus, ACT will fully unify with Ancora, an education data science and research company it acquired in 2018 and since has been operating as a wholly owned subsidiary of ACT. ACT and Encora will begin operating as a single unified public benefit corporation with ACT's name and brand upon close, an ACT spokesman said. The integrated business, known as ACT, will advance the organization's leadership in education and workforce readiness as it serves the needs of all ACT stockholders through new investments in ACT's products and people. ACT Chief Executive Officer Janet Goodwin will continue to lead the new company. Our partnership with Nexus Capital Management uniquely positions ACT to meet a watershed moment in our nation as the demand for talent is growing and becoming more diverse, Goodwin said in a statement arguing the country's need for trained workers after high school and college has never been higher, nor has the need to ensure that every learner has access to equitable college and career planning resources, guidance, and insights. The partnership and unification will not result in any layoffs, officials said. ACT last summer laid off more than 100 employees and also disclosed plans to sell more of the properties in its East Iowa City campus off Scott Boulevard. ACT hasn't shared publicly terms of its new partnership with Nexus, including how much funding the investment firm is providing. Nexus's March 2024 public disclosure forms filed with the U.S. government show it advises for private funds administered in the United States and Cayman Islands, reporting feeder funds organized in the Cayman Islands valued at hundreds of millions. By integrating ACT's assessment systems and workforce solutions with Encora's data-driven enrollment services, ACT aims to more precisely connect students and job seekers to institutions of higher education and employers. Among its forward-looking intentions, ACT aims to simplify and streamline the college application process for students and institutions, better match employers with available talent, create new opportunities for upskilling mid- and late-career professionals, help learners identify their strengths, and provide recommendations about applying them in education settings and the workplace, and provide more integrated and actionable insights into states, districts, families, and learners. Nexus's investment portfolio includes Sava's Learning Company, previously Pearson Education, Tom's, a lightweight shoe company, and Sugar Bear, a beauty and wellness company. In addition, proceeds from the partnership will fund the continuation of an Iowa nonprofit organization that will be headquartered in Iowa City. The nonprofit will conduct programs, services, and research focused on education and workplace success, officials said. It also will retain an investment in the new corporation and have representation on ACT's board. Iowa is among 13 Republican-led states joining a lawsuit challenging a federal rule that the states argue overstates the fuel efficiency of electric vehicles, the Iowa Attorney General's office announced. The Biden administration last month announced new emission standards for passenger cars designed to reduce planet-warming emissions, the Associated Press reported. The lawsuit claims the Federal Department of Energy, in the new rules, overstated electric vehicles' fuel efficiency, lacked the legal authority to impose the rules, failed to perform a required environmental impact statement, and that the new rules are arbitrary and capricious. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, in a news release, argued the new federal rules favor electric vehicles and will cause harm to Iowa farmers and producers of corn-based ethanol. Lawyers for Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds argued on Thursday that the state Supreme Court should allow a fetal heartbeat abortion ban to take effect, while opponents fought to keep the measure blocked. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments over the law, which a district court blocked last year shortly after Reynolds signed it into law following a special legislative session. The arguments are the latest in a long legal battle over abortion restrictions in the state. The law at issue this time would ban abortion once cardiac activity can be detected in a fetus, which can be as early as 6 weeks before many women know they're pregnant. During the hearing, the justices questioned lawyers for the state and Planned Parenthood, largely focusing on which legal standard should be applied to the law. Since Iowa's Supreme Court no longer recognizes a fundamental right to abortion in the state constitution, Iowa Solicitor General Eric Wesson argued the lower-level, rational basis standard should be applied and the law should take effect. He argued the undue burden standard imposed by federal law before Roe v. Wade was overturned and should not be applied. A similar law was passed and signed in 2018, but a district court found it unconstitutional under a previous state court decision which declared a fundamental right to an abortion existed in the state constitution. The Iowa Supreme Court in 2022 reversed that standard, but stated that Iowa was bound by the undue burden standard then imposed by federal precedent that guaranteed a right to an abortion. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade days later on June 24, 2022, removing that federal standard and overturning the 50-year-old right to abortion. In 2023, Reynolds unsuccessfully asked the Iowa Supreme Court to revive the 2018 law. The court did not approve that request, prompting Republican lawmakers to pass a nearly identical law that summer. A district court blocked that law shortly afterward, saying that it violated the standard set out in the court's 2022 opinion. Peter M., the lawyer for Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers, said the district court was correct in its decision and the law should remain blocked, arguing it violates several areas of the state constitution, including due process and a guarantee of equal rights for women. Planned Parenthood is asking the Supreme Court to send the case back to the district court, where they hope to further develop their arguments. There is no set date for the court to decide the case, but most cases are decided by the end of the court's term. This year's term ends June 28th. Reynolds, a Republican, said in a statement Thursday that the overturning of Roe v. Wade gave states the right to decide how to limit abortion. For Iowa, the people's elected representatives have drawn a clear line multiple times at when a heartbeat begins, Reynolds said. Today, the unborn had their day at the Iowa Supreme Court. As a pro-life governor, I will do everything I can to protect the innocent unborn and promote strong, healthy families. Republican Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, who was in the courtroom for oral arguments Thursday, said in a statement she would continue to defend the state law, and she was confident it would be found constitutional. State Senator Janice Wiener, a Democrat from Iowa City, said the arguments presented by Planned Parenthood were convincing and called the law an unconstitutional attempt to control the bodies of Iowans and their futures. Iowans value their freedom, and that includes the freedom to make decisions about their bodies and their health care with their doctors. A majority of Iowans oppose attacks on their health care choices, Wiener said in a statement. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican from New Hartford, told reporters Thursday that Republicans are confident in the legislation and hopeful it will survive the legal challenge. Some justices expressed skepticism about parts of the state's argument Thursday, but others showed a willingness to uphold the law that Reynolds has appointed five of the court's seven justices, while two were appointed by former Republican Governor Terry Branstad. Chief Justice Susan Christensen questioned the rationale of the exceptions allowed under the heartbeat bill, suggesting they might not survive legal scrutiny. The law allows an exception in cases of rapes that are reported within 45 days and incest that is reported within 140 days, as well as exceptions when the life of the mother is threatened. She said the time limit imposed is too narrow to feasibly allow those cases to be reported. Wesson said the law requires only that the woman seeking an abortion report the rape or incest to her doctor and not to a law enforcement agency, calling the policy not unreasonable. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley said he's hesitant to advance a bill that would allow those sexually abused as children while in the Boy Scouts to recover more money through a national bankruptcy settlement. Lawmakers face a rapidly approaching April 19th deadline to change the law, or else Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country. The bill unanimously passed the Iowa Senate this week. Though narrowly written to apply only to the Boy Scout bankruptcy settlement, Grassley said he is concerned about broadening Iowa's civil statute of limitations. Speaking to reporters Thursday, the Republican from New Hartford called it a significant policy change that merits further scrutiny. Senate File 2431 creates an exception to Iowa's civil statute of limitations for injuries resulting from childhood sexual abuse for purposes of making a claim in a bankruptcy proceeding that was initiated on February 18, 2020, against the bankruptcy estate of a congressionally chartered organization. The language effectively would limit the exception to the Boy Scouts. The act would be repealed December 31, 2026. It would temporarily lift the state's statute of limitations so that victims of sexual abuse while in the Boy Scouts can receive damages from the Scouting Settlement Trust, a $2.5 billion fund established last year after the Scouts filed for bankruptcy protection. Scouts filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement approved in court in 2022 that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million for claims against the Boy Scouts of America, as well as all claims against local Boy Scouts councils and supporting organizations. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who said they were abused as children by troop leaders. But unless Iowa legislators take action in the next few days, the estimated 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they otherwise would be entitled to. When figuring compensation, the settlement uses a matrix that weighs a variety of factors, including a state's civil statute of limitations. Iowa's statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult that their injuries and suffering are related to their alleged abuse. Because of Iowa's short statute of limitation, victims in the state could see their financial compensation from the Scouts reduced by 60 to 70% compared with victims in other states, according to an attorney involved in the matter. And even then, people might be paid only 5 to 10% of the value because there's not enough money in the fund. Pressed on the prospects of the House passing the bill in time, Grassley was less than optimistic. This is a much bigger deal than I think it's being perceived to be, he told reporters. Changing this is a fundamental change to the way we've typically done things in Iowa when it comes to the statute of limitations and should not be rushed through. That being said, I understand the clock is ticking as well, but we have to be mindful to make a good policy decision versus looking at what timeline we're under. Iowa officials in 2021 lifted the state's statute of limitations for bringing criminal charges in sexual abuse, incest, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking cases, but the law does not cover civil claims. Opponents have expressed concerns that getting rid of the statute could make it virtually impossible in some cases for organizations to defend themselves against a claim for third-party liability in decades-old cases. Senator Janet Peterson, a Democrat from Des Moines, said the bill will prevent Iowa abuse survivors from being financially penalized simply because their abuse occurred in Iowa. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat from Windsor Heights, and House Democrats support the bill and are anxious to do this for these survivors. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 12th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Anna Mae Miller, 77, died peacefully Tuesday. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. April 15th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Iowa City. Visitation will be Sunday from 3:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service of Iowa City, where the rosary will be recited at 3 p.m. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Regina Foundation or to the Daughters of the American Revolution for the Iowa Room at the DAR National Headquarters in Washington, D.C. Anna Mae was born September 21, 1946, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. She was a 1964 graduate of Regina High School. On October 2, 1965, Anna Mae married Charles Miller at St. Mary Church. Following high school, she became a dental assistant for Dr. Kottemann. Anna Mae was later employed at UIHC in the payroll department, where she worked until her retirement. Anna Mae was a member of St. Mary Church, where she was a past president of the church council. She was very active in the Nathaniel Fellows chapter of Daughters of the American Revolution, serving in all offices, including regent. Anna Mae was a volunteer at Mercy Hospital with over 2,500 hours of service and with the Mercy Hospital Guild, where she was the guild president. Gwendolyn Mary Bulger, age 95, passed away peacefully at Clarence Nursing Home on April 9th. Gwen was born at home on January 12, 1929. She enjoyed growing up on the family farm and attended country school and then graduated high school in Lisbon. She kept busy raising her 9 children and later in life worked at several area factories. She chose cremation and no funeral. The family will hold a memorial get-together on Saturday, June 8th at the enclosed pavilion in the main city park in Mechanicsville from noon to 3 p.m. The family asks that no flowers be sent. Memorials in Gwen's honor may be directed to the Mechanicsville Fire Department or the Clarence Nursing Home in Clarence, noted Bulger Memorial for staff. Kenneth Raymond Klein, 85, of Iowa City, passed away Thursday, April 4th, at Mercy Hospital. A celebration of life will be held Sunday, May 26th, at the Park Lodge at Terry Trueblood in Iowa City, beginning at noon, followed by a funeral mass at 3 p.m. A private family committal will be held at St. Stanislaus Cemetery in Hills. Gerald Kenneth Lang, 74, of Toddville, died Wednesday, April 10th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital following a long illness. Funeral Mass will be 10 a.m. Monday, April 15th at St. Matthew Catholic Church. The burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Monday from 9 to 10 a.m. at the church. Memorials may be directed to the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Make-A-Wish, Iowa, in Urbandale. In some other notable obituaries, O.J. Simpson, the football star and Hollywood actor, acquitted of charges he killed his former wife and her friend in a trial that mesmerized the public and exposed divisions on race and policing in America, has died. He was 76. The family announced on Simpson's official X account that he died Wednesday of prostate cancer. He died in Las Vegas, officials said Thursday. Simpson earned fame, fortune, and adulation through football and show business, but his legacy was forever changed by the June 1994 knife slayings of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, in Los Angeles. He was later found liable for the deaths in a separate civil case and then served 9 years in prison on unrelated charges. Goldman's father, Fred, and his sister, Kim, released a statement acknowledging that the hope for true accountability has ended. Live TV coverage of Simpson's arrest after a famous slow-speed chase marked a stunning fall from grace. His trial captured America's attention on live TV. The case sparked debates on race, gender, domestic abuse, celebrity justice, and police misconduct. Evidence found at the scene seemed overwhelmingly against Simpson. Blood drops, bloody footprints, and a glove were there. Another glove, smeared with blood, was found at his home. Simpson didn't testify, but the prosecution asked him to try on the gloves in court. He struggled to squeeze them onto his hands and spoke his only 3 words of the trial, "They're too small." His attorney, Johnny L. Cochran, Jr., told the jurors, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." The jury found him not guilty of murder in 1995, but a separate civil trial jury found him liable in 1997 for the deaths and ordered him to pay $33.5 million to relatives of Brown and Goldman. A decade later, still shadowed by the California wrongful death judgment, Simpson led 5 men he barely knew into a confrontation with 2 sports memorabilia dealers in a cramped Las Vegas hotel room. 2 men with Simpson had guns. A jury convicted Simpson of armed robbery and other felonies. Imprisoned at 61, he served 9 years in a remote Nevada prison, including a stint as a janitor. He wasn't contrite when he was released on parole in October 2017. The parole board heard him insist yet again that he was only trying to retrieve memorabilia and heirlooms stolen from him. Public fascination with Simpson never faded. Many debated whether he had been punished in Las Vegas for his acquittal in Los Angeles. In 2016, he was the subject of an FX miniseries and a 5-part ESPN documentary. 12 years later, following an outpouring of public outrage, Rupert Murdoch canceled a planned book by the News Corporation owned HarperCollins, in which Simpson offered his hypothetical account of the killings. It was to be titled, "If I Did It." Goldman's family, still doggedly pursuing the multi-million-dollar wrongful death judgment, won control of the manuscript. They retitled the book, "If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer." Less than 2 months after losing rights to the book, Simpson was arrested in Las Vegas. Simpson's football rise happened simultaneously with a television career. He signed a contract with ABC Sports the night he won the Heisman Trophy in 1968. That same year, he appeared on the NBC series Dragnet and Ironside. During his pro career, Simpson was a color commentator for a decade on ABC, followed by a stint on NBC. In 1983, he joined ABC's Monday Night Football. Simpson became a charismatic pitchman. In 1975, Hertz made him the first black man hired for a corporate national ad campaign. The commercials featuring Simpson running through the airports toward the Hertz desk and young girls chanting, "Go, OJ, go," were ubiquitous. Simpson made his big screen debut in 1974's The Klansman, an exploitation film in which he starred alongside Lee Marvin and Richard Burton. The film flopped. But Simpson would go on to appear in several dozen films and TV series, including 1974's The Towering Inferno, 1976's The Cassandra Crossing, 1977's Roots, and 1977's Capricorn One. Most notable, perhaps, was 1988's The Naked Gun from the Files of Police Squad and two sequels. Simpson played Detective Nordberg in the slapstick films opposite Leslie Nielsen. Of course, Simpson went on to other fame. One of the artifacts of his murder trial, the tailored tan suit he wore when acquitted, was donated and displayed at the museum in Washington. Simpson had been told the suit would be in the hotel room in Las Vegas, but it wasn't there. Orenthal James Simpson was born July 9, 1947, in San Francisco, where he grew up in government-subsidized housing. After graduating from high school, he enrolled at City College of San Francisco for a year and a half before transferring to the University of Southern California for the spring 1967 semester. He married Marguerite Whitley on June 24, 1967, moving her to Los Angeles the next day so he could begin preparing for his first season with USC, which, in large part because of Simpson, won that year's national championship. On the day he accepted the Heisman Trophy, his first child, Arnell, was born. He had two sons, Jason and Aaron, with his first wife. One of those boys, Aaron, drowned as a toddler in a swimming pool accident in 1979, the same year he and Whitley divorced. Simpson and Brown were married in 1985. They had two children, Justin and Sydney, and divorced in 1992. 2 years later, Nicole Brown Simpson was found dead. C.J. Snare, the lead singer of the pop metal band Firehouse, died last Friday from cardiac arrest. He was 64. CJ was expected to be back on stage with the band this summer after recovering from surgery. Snare's bombastic vocal work and keyboard arrangements helped make Firehouse singles such as Don't Treat Me Bad, Reach for the Sky, and Love of a Lifetime staples of the early 90s hair metal scene. Snare co-founded the group in 1987 in Charlotte, North Carolina, and its 1990 self-titled debut LP went double platinum. While the band's popularity waxed and waned in influence as hair metal turned to grunge in the 90s, the group maintained a global fan base and was especially popular in Asia and continued to tour headline dates and hard rock festivals. Its most recent album, 2011's Full Circle, featured re-recordings of old material. In September, Snare announced he was taking a brief leave to recover from abdominal surgery. The hip-hop DJ, known as Mr. C, hailed as legendary for pioneering the genre and championing its rising stars, has died at the age of 57. No cause of death was given by his family, who confirmed his passing to New York's Hot 97, the birthplace of his career in the 1990s. Born Calvin LeBrun in 1966, Mr. C rose to become one of the most prominent DJs in New York City, most notably as the official DJ for Big Daddy Kane and for helping launch the career of the Notorious Big, all three hailed from the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. During his 21 years at Hot 97, Mr. C not only influenced radio culture, but also helped kickstart the careers of Jay-Z, 50 Cent, Alicia Keys, and other well-known R&B hip-hop artists. His Hot 97 show, Throwback at Noon, was among the most popular in that time slot. Stints at 94.7, The Block and Rock, The Bells on Sirius XM, followed his Hot's 97 tenure, the station statement said. Retired Colonel Ralph Puckett Jr., an Army Ranger who received the Medal of Honor in 2021, 71 years after the valiant combat actions in the Korean War for which he was decorated and who became one of the most honored soldiers in U.S. military history, died April 8th at his home in Columbus, Georgia. He was 97. The cause was complications from Parkinson's disease, said his wife Jean Puckett. At age 94, Colonel Puckett traveled to the White House to receive the Medal of Honor, leaving behind both his wheelchair and walker to stand straight as President Joe Biden draped the military's top award for valor around his neck. The decoration for Colonel Puckett was years in the making, championed by close and influential friends in the military community who wanted to upgrade his Distinguished Service Cross. He had been presented with the DSC, the second highest honor award for valor, soon after a fierce battle on a Korean hilltop. Starting on November 25, 1950, then First Lieutenant Puckett and his fellow soldiers with the 8th Army Ranger Company assaulted and took command of Hill 205, frozen high ground about 60 miles from the Chinese border. It was near the outset of what became known as the Battle of Changchun River, in which senior U.S. commanders were caught by surprise by China's full-scale entry into the Korean War. To succeed in his objective, he was credited with deliberately braving enemy machine gun fire to help his men locate and kill a Chinese sniper. The Chinese launched swarming wave attacks of small arms and mortar fire for hours in bitterly cold temperatures. The American soldiers were outnumbered 10-1, according to Army accounts, but Lieutenant Puckett, despite being wounded by a hand grenade, helped his men defeat five successive Chinese counterattacks that stretched into the early morning of November 26. On the 6th Chinese counterattack, the Rangers were overrun after Lieutenant Puckett was told that further artillery fire was unavailable to support them. He and his men engaged in hand-to-hand combat, and Lieutenant Puckett suffered additional wounds from mortars that left him unable to move. He ordered his soldiers to abandon him to enable them to have a better chance of withdrawing alive. Two privates, First Class Billy G. Walls and David L. Pollock, carried him to safety. They later received the Silver Star for their valor in saving him. In an oral history project, Lieutenant Puckett recalled seeing Chinese soldiers attacking U.S. servicemen with bayonets 15 yards away from him when Walls and Pollock arrived by his side. He said that he was glad the men disobeyed his order to leave him. For 18 years, beginning in 2003, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel J. Locke, a historian who had written extensively on the Rangers, sought to have Colonel Puckett recognized with the Medal of Honor. In 2021, Jean Puckett told the Washington Post that her husband felt the Distinguished Service Cross was honor enough, but Locke and other members of Colonel Puckett's immediate family wanted to see the effort through. It required extensive research on what happened during the battle and the Army reassessing whether Colonel Puck's actions deserved the Medal of Honor. And in some sports news, the crowd at Bob Murphy Stadium sat silent in suspense. Most everyone, even Benton Community Boys soccer coach Will Stockman, wasn't sure if Caleb Gessner's shot in extra time had crossed the goal line. Finally, after a few prolonged moments of tension, the referee gave the signal, "Good! Game over! Bobcats win!" Gessner's game-winning goal Tuesday gave Benton a 2-1 win over Class 2A No. 1 Williamsburg. His score, which came late in extra time, almost never happened. Approximately 2 minutes before Gessner's walk-off shot, brother Casey Gessner, who scored Benton's only goal in regulation, narrowly missed a header on a pass from the corner. By Caleb Gessner making the final shot, he tied his brother at 3 goals scored apiece this season. Tuesday's win also was a stroke of revenge for the Bobcats. In 2023, Williamsburg defeated Benton twice. The second loss ended Benton's season. Stout defense and the Gessner brothers' scoring have been the key ingredients to Benton's strong start. The Bobcats have allowed just 2 goals through 4 games. An outstanding winter athletics season highlighted by national champions and NCAA championship team success has propelled the Iowa State Athletics Department up to number 17 in the Division I Learfield Directors' Cup standings. Gymnastics, in which Iowa State reached the NCAA championships, has not yet been added to the totals. Iowa State has its highest ranking at this point in the year ever, surpassing the previous high of 20th in the 1996-97 winter standings. It is only the 6th time the Cyclones have ever been in the top 25 at the end of the winter, others being 96, 97, 2000, 2010, 2022, and 2024. Iowa State ranks second among Big 12 schools, trailing only Texas, which is number 2 in the team standings. Iowa is 31st. The ISU wrestling team placed 4th in the NCAA championship. The men's basketball team reached the Sweet 16, and the women's team advanced to the second round of the NCAA tournament. In women's basketball, Kirkwood women's basketball coach Kim Mule was named the 2023-24 NJCAA Division II Coach of the Year after leading the Eagles to their 9th national title. In 34 seasons, Coach Mall had compiled a 1,045 win, 171 defeat, .859 record, and currently is the NJCAA women's basketball all-time leader in wins. 2 Kirkwood players also received honors this week from the NJCAA for their play on the court. Sophomore Demetria Prewitt and freshman Jenna Twett were named NJCAA Division II First Team All-Americans. In minor league baseball, Cedar Rapids Colonels pitcher John Stankiewicz has been transferred to AA Wichita, the Minnesota Twins announced Thursday. The 2024 Cedar Rapids roster sits at 29 active players, with 4 on the injured list. Cedar Rapids played Game 3 of its 6-game home opening series against Dayton last night. A Linn County panel devoted to raising awareness of stigma surrounding mental health and resources for support recommended the county explore making changes to county worker benefits and improving communication about mental health to employees. In 2021, the Linn County Board of Supervisors approved making Linn County a registered Make It Okay workplace, committing the county to reducing the stigma surrounding mental health and helping people get support they need. This action has increased Make It Okay ambassadors among county staff, established a resource hub for employee mental health, incorporated Make It Okay overview in a new employee orientation, added telehealth to the county's employee assistance program, and worked to provide private space in all buildings and departments. Based on the feedback from respondents, the committee recommended the county explore additional mental health or personal days or more paid time off in general. Other possibilities to improve employee benefits were more mental health components in the county wellness program and more mental health coverage on insurance, promoting team building with countywide events, networking among departments, and valuing staff input also were recommended. There also should be training on coping skills, how to support people with mental illness, and recognizing signs of suicide and talking to staff about mental health. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 12, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.